Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks for listening to another episode of All Better. Your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is Rich Voss. This was an episode I did very early on. It was really clunky. Thought I lost the audio. Rich started, tearing into me, breaking my nuts about not knowing what I'm doing. And now it's going to listen to my podcast. So thanks, Rich. This episode was salvageable thanks to John Edwards. So let's meet Rich Voss. Rich Voss has 4 specials on Comedy Central and over 100 television appearances. He's been seen on HBO, HBO Max, Netflix, Showtime, and Stars. Rich also has produced and starred in the documentary Women Aren't Funny. He appeared in Judd Apatow's King of Staten Island. He's a 2-time writer for the Academy Awards, which has hosted Woodstock 99, the Virus Tour, and the Washington Monument Drug Awareness Concert. Voss can be heard on numerous top podcasts such as What the F, Marc Maron, The Church of What's Happening Now with Joe Diaz, and the Joe Rogan Experience. Along with his wife, Bonnie McFarlane, Rich has his own hit podcast, My Wife Hates Me. It looks inside the marriage and day-to-day life of the two comics. Rich has also been clean and sober for 35 years, leading to performances at countless 12-step conventions. He has 6 albums in rotation on Sirius XM, and he has the best roast in the history of roasts on YouTube, Boss Roast. I'd like to thank Rich for stopping by today. Not today. It was probably 7 months ago. But you get to listen to it today. Meet Rich Voss. We're here with Rich Voss at All Better. My friend, Mark Boriosi, and Rich's friend put us together. Rich, I'm glad you made time to come on our podcast.
Thank you. No problem. Well, it is a problem, but
yeah. Where are you at right now?
I'm in my basement, but I only see half of you. Yeah. Your camera. Is this your first podcast?
It's my first, not the first episode, but it's my first podcast. Yeah, All Better.
No, this isn't the first one.
No, this is episode 24, Rich.
Oh, okay. You see how I'm right in the middle?
Yeah.
I only see 7/8 of your head.
Yeah, I don't even really add video unless I put it on the Patreon. And all my subscribers, they're growing. It was on Apple and Spotify. They're just listening to it. I put a preview on. But if the Patreon users like it, I put the video from this up.
Oh, I get it. Mm-hmm. So it's mainly based on audio.
Yeah.
You sound like shit.
Thank you.
No.
Thanks.
What's up?
Thanks, Dad.
I'm not that much older than you.
I designed the podcast pretty much to talk about personal recovery stories, friends in entertainment. And then I have a kind of a lane that's for clinicians, definitions of disorders, authors of books. And then the third lane was agents of change. I had a political background, judges, representatives holding public office, that either need to be educated, or what is their understanding of addiction, and how is that going to translate into more humane policy?
Well, I mean, if you're trying to get politicians and normal people to basically understand there's two types of counselors. There's the counselor that's in recovery that was an ex-drug addict, and there's a counselor that went to school to become a counselor. Out of my, I guess, experience or my preference is the counselor that's an ex-drug addict.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a counselor. In life, to me, this is just my opinion. Mm-hmm. Street smarter is, to me, is smarter than book smart in certain situations. And to me, drug addiction, just to me, is that situation. It's hard to teach. You can't teach somebody what it feels like after you burn yourself. You can't teach somebody that. You can't teach somebody what it's like to slam your door in a finger until you slam your door in a finger. You can go, oh my God, that hurt. So I did a show years ago in D.C., a drug awareness thing. I hosted on the Washington Monument with, you know, Steven Tyler, Sheryl Crow, all these musicians, and it's a drug awareness. If they're not aware in Washington or throughout different states that there's a fucking drug problem, there's nothing you're going to say, in my opinion. The writing's on the wall. Kids are dropping dead from fentanyl, from overdosing. There's meth abuse, there's heroin abuse, there's coke abuse, there's freebase, there's pure alcoholism. So what do you have to say to politicians that they don't know already? Does that make sense?
It does. But meet some, and you have, they don't know a lot. They really don't. And I've met people in recovery that don't know what's wrong with them. To the degree that they thought drugs and alcohol are the problem, which it is not. And drugs and alcohol do not cause addiction. Trauma in a mind does. You're nesting something for an addiction. The mind's already there for addiction.
Well, it's not always trauma. It's
not always detachment. Like,
you know, some of the people from the best homes are addicted. Some from the worst homes.
Yep.
There's addicted to instant gratification. There's addiction is mental 100 times more than physical.
Yeah.
Obviously, because you're going to, you know, you're going to beat the physical addiction. And
sure.
Yeah. You know, the obsession and compulsion is what you're dealing with. And I'm an obsessive compulsive person. I'm wearing 5 fucking diamond rings. All right. I got 36 years clean, but I'm still empty.
Yeah.
Okay. Go up to my room. There's 40 pairs of Nikes. See these hats? I got about 15 different pairs.
Yeah.
Because that empty hole, which should be filled with, well, I'm not going to talk about God because it's not a God thing. Mm-hmm. It's just the addiction to, it's trying to fill the empty void with whatever covers that hole. Does that make sense?
It does. My empty void myself that everyone describes that I know that's had addiction also has like a background noise of anxiety my entire life. And it's like a clenched fist in my head and my stomach. When I drank or used cocaine, it would unclench. I felt normal. I felt like I had my mind was fluid for this period of time. I saw an interview with you and you described that. And you also described a prior condition of abandonment, feeling abandoned. And this idea I could relate to, or this insecure attachment disorder. You're feeling that all the time. That's there prior to that. So if I was going to teach politicians anything, if you're going to do something, it's to redefine that term. What is the prior condition that I'm medicating? And it's a societal problem. It's detachment. It's cortisol. People come from a good house, weren't abused. Well, what produced the cortisol in a pregnancy that didn't allow your dopamine system to fully mature in that brain? And then I meet nicotine, alcohol, and it's like, wow, that makes sense. That should be in there. But I heard you say that, and I related to it.
Well, I'm showing this right now. I've been on it for 16 years.
Yeah, I'm doing both.
Smoking 3 packs a day. I've had anxiety since I was 21. But back then, they didn't know what anxiety was. We just put you in the hospital and gave you Thorazine, Haldol.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be 65. 21 years ago is, 44 years ago. They didn't really know what anxiety was. They weren't treating anxiety back then, 44 years ago. And I get anxiety more when I talk about it.
Yeah.
But I don't think anxiety is what caused me to get high.
No,
I caused anxiety, more anxiety.
There's a relationship. It's hard for me, myself personally, to pull away. Okay, I have an addiction, stone cold addict. But it's fueled by this anxiety. Sometimes it's a background noise of I never felt safe. I didn't know that. I would never articulate that, but I'm always tense. I'm looking for threats. Is there too much noise in the room? Who's this person? What's that? When I'm drunk, I think I finally felt like I was normal. Like people aren't always assessing everything.
Yeah, I don't know. It's such a weird, there's so many different
variations,
variables.
Yeah.
Hold on. Hello?
I thought you were going to the city.
I am. After I do this podcast, I'm going to New York.
Oh.
6:30.
Who's that?
It's a drug addiction podcast.
Oh.
It's just a drug addict.
The only drug you're addicted to now is me.
I'm addicted to you. Oh, please. whatever. I don't want to be dirty.
Yeah.
But I didn't say anything dirty. There's so many different. Look, to me, here's the thing. You cross that fine line of social use to addiction. There's no turning back.
Yeah.
Whatever makes you cross that fine line, everybody has their own personal story. But I think after your own, anybody's own personal story kicks in, then it's just obsession and compulsion or physical addiction.
Yeah.
Whatever the reason, whatever drug you're doing. If you're doing heroin, then it's a physical addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get started, maybe you got started, you or anybody got started because of anxiety, because of feeling less than or feeling they're a product of their environment, whatever I think the case may be, then physical or obsession and compulsion kicks in.
Yeah.
Because, if you say you have anxiety and a person and they're drinking to calm the anxiety down. Well, now they're a full-blown alcoholic. It's not about anxiety anymore. It's about, I got to get a drink so I don't have the DTs.
Yeah.
I can function. So, there's so many different.
Yeah, there is.
I'm wrong. I'm not a fucking doctor. It's just, I've had anxiety for over 40 years, and sometimes I have to take medication.
Mm-hmm.
The last 2 years since the pandemic, I haven't had to take it as much.
Really?
Because my stress level's down because I'm not working as much.
Yeah.
When I was working, going on stage, and I always took a half. I never took I always took less than. And then I had a mental addiction. Now I'm going on stage, so I'll take a half of anxiety pill with clonazepam or whatever. And because I always think, well, this is the time it's all going to fall apart.
Oh, God, yeah.
This is it. This is where I piss myself. I just drool on the audience. Just something. This is it. And now, maybe, you know, from 8 out of 10 times taking anxiety medicine, going on stage, I'm probably 4 out of 10 times, half.
Yeah.
And again, it's only half of what I'm prescribed because, you know, if you're prescribed, like they say,
sure, you're
prescribed one and you take 2 or 3, well, then there's a fucking problem. So I take a half.
Rich, you got sober early in your career, like in the 80s. Was that, did I read that right? 1987?
Yeah, 88. I think I had like 3 years in comedy.
Yeah.
So, and
wow, that's phenomenal. That idea, being in entertainment, especially comedy, like gigging every night. Were there other guys that were in your wheelhouse that were sober as support?
Yeah. But then I guess there was comics I used to run with, you know, and we'd go get high, go up to Harlem, Spanish Harlem, whatever, cop our drug of choice, and mainly mine. And
yeah,
they were just tagging along or trying it or whatever. But then there was the guys I grew up with, those that were my real drug addict friends, which I cut loose once I got clean. I cut loose. I still had to work with certain comics. I just didn't go into New York after the show and spend my money. I really went to a lot of 12-step meetings in the beginning, on and off.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the last 2 years, a lot of Zoom meetings.
Yeah.
It's convenient, but they had one for comedians.
Wow.
So it was a lot of people. Like, it was tough for me to go. Not tough, but, you know, I wouldn't go to an in-person meeting. You know, it's all these dudes and fucking, you know, Tims and blue-collar workers. And it's really hard to talk about, you know,
entertainment,
because it sounds like ego.
Yeah, it does.
It sounds like, oh, who's this guy think he is? Oh, it's a nightmare for him to be backstage at the Oscars. Or, you know, I'm hosting Woodstock and I'm saying what a nightmare it was being at Woodstock.
Yeah.
Until I found the AA tent, you know. So talking about my business in a regular meeting, I try not to. I just try to relay what I'm dealing with without, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then I found a Zoom meeting with actors, comics, writers, and it was easier to talk.
That's
great. And it's convenient. You just go downstairs and turn on your fucking computer. And then we have a step meeting on Tuesday and then a topic meeting. And I got more involved through it. I was getting speakers for about a half a year or 4 months. I come up with a topic every Thursday on the topic meeting. I really need to work a better program, you know, when it comes to steps. I got 36 years. I shouldn't be as angry and I shouldn't have jealousy or envy like I do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not perfect, but I do.
No.
I mean, I played a lottery. I got fucking, honest. I'll gamble if I'm in a casino. Like the other night, I was in a casino in Canada. I won. One guy rolled the dice. I won. I said, I'm leaving. Eventually, I'll lose. So I walked out after. I was there for 10 minutes. I won like 200. I go, that's enough. But it was just, you know, whatever. I'm an instant gratification.
Dopamine.
Huh?
The dopamine.
Yeah.
It's comforting.
If it's not buying golf clubs or food, it's whatever the fuck makes you feel good.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah, it is. It is. Have you, in these last 30 years, ever played with meditation? Any mindfulness practices that...
My wife.
Yeah.
Who's not in a program, it meditates now. And I walk across the room and she's like, and I get such fucking resentment. I've been in 36 years. I've never really tried. I don't know if I have.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not. I go to meetings. I do everything, but I don't work a good program because I don't meditate. You know, I mean.
Yeah, it doesn't. I couldn't do it for a while during the pandemic. That's what I did, Zoom. But I started doing 10 minutes because the house would have been destructive. My mind's crazy. I'm anxious. I'm thinking, you know, everything's going to collapse. My wife's not listening to me. I got a plan. I don't want to drink. Yeah. But I started doing 10 minutes on a nap and it was profound. And I did a fourth step. I started writing again. And it was amazing how I didn't think I was wrong about a lot of things that were bothering me or just causing that angst. And to write it down and then tell someone else, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm not looking at this the right way. And then when I got to like step six, it gives you like this space, an hour. I couldn't do the hour. It says sit down for an hour, think about what you just did. I got through about 30 minutes. I'm like, I got to check my phone. Someone could have called me. I would have. But it became a practice. And what happens now is I have this space. When anxiety, discomfort, envy, it comes in, I'll be driving. I'm arguing with a guy I haven't seen in 20 years in my head. I can't wait to fucking see him. I'll settle up.
Oh, I've had those arguments.
I see it coming. I'm like, oh man, I can let it pass. It doesn't change my thoughts. I still think the same way. I just let it go down the stream now. Just, but I could never do that my whole life. I would be lost in thought for an hour settling up with someone I haven't even seen. Like just that's an hour of my day now.
I do it. I have grown. I mean, because I'm in a business like club owners. I want to write to them and go, oh, I guess loyalty and friendship is really, I guess I had it wrong. I thought we were friends, you know.
Yeah.
No, I just try to move on. You know, one guy, on a daily basis, I want to tell people to go fuck themselves. I really do, because I'm in a business with some very, you're not good people.
Sure.
You know, and I don't know. I try to do the right things. I try to do the right things and not act out as much. But I've had arguments with people that screwed me for $25.
Yeah.
30 years ago in my head, I'm going, how the fuck did they get away with that?
It's not the money. Yeah. They knew I was weak. They know what I'm thinking about myself. They didn't know what. Do you find it hard, like with comedy, if you're ever grouched, like doing a brainstorm or just generate some emotion at the end of a bit, does that linger or is there a way to parse that? Does that ever put you in a bad mood looking to be critical? Because some of the comics I relate to, you know, I've heard your sets or like a George Carlin. Like, how do you take away the set and not be in a mood looking for things all the time? Everything's fucked up.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wiem, the host of All Better, but I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. And at Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, and exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. In Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and assure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com.
Well, usually I try to work in a moment. Like,
yeah,
I was in a club this week in Canada, and I mean, just super numbers, and I'm not getting the money I should be getting.
Yeah.
That other guys are getting, and my manager didn't make a good deal. And I'm going up with resentment, but it's not the audience's fault.
No.
So I'm trying to kill, and which I was destroying. I mean, and Saturday night was sold out like both shows, and I'm like, why am I not getting whatever? But I'm still getting decent money.
Yeah.
My wife is going, why are you working for that? I'm good at what I do. I've been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting is a decent living.
Yeah.
So I was going up with a little resentment. I text my manager, you know, what the fuck? Give me a bonus, do that. He goes, next time. And he doesn't want to deal with such small bullshit. But it's in my head because I know the guy coming in next week is probably getting double. And I'm doing almost the same numbers and I'm a better comic. So I'm going up there. But I got to let that go.
Yeah.
And it's not the people's fault that came. They came, you know. And then the last night I'm on Sunday, which I hate doing Sunday. After two shows Saturday, it's such a, you know, sold out Saturday and Sunday, 100 people. This pro-political guy started saying something to me, and this is Canada. I should have said, you're not, this is not your fight.
Yeah. This is not.
And I really want, but he was a gorilla.
Yeah.
And I defused the situation, but not the way I really wanted to, saying you're ridiculous and you're stupid. That's what I wanted to.
Yeah.
But I defused it in a funny way. And then I just got off stage. He came up, oh, great show. But I just came off and I went, what a fucking, this guy's an idiot.
Yeah.
So I try to, a show doesn't affect me. Maybe five, the only time it really might affect me is if somehow I hurt somebody and made them feel horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't want to do that. You know, and it doesn't barely happen, but, you know, like there was a drunk lady, you know, they're drunk and whatever. And I say stuff and they walk out and their friends stay and I say, well, shut up, quit drinking or acting out. But I don't want somebody to leave hurt. You know, I'm not going to attack someone for being overweight, but I'll attack somebody. An attack, but I'll make fun of somebody with a ridiculous hairdo.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
Yeah, there is. It's weird to understand that. That's
what's that?
That's keen because there is a difference. Like, especially in comedy, being in a club for the night, that's a distinction most people don't talk about, attacking someone's weight, but you coming in with hair, it's, I mean, that's a. Most people don't observe that stuff where the line is. I think most good comedians do.
Yeah, some comedians, there's no line.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make them bad. That's who they are. But I look, if somebody comes in with a, you know, half a head, I'm not going to call them half a head. You know, there's certain, God, there was a scene from Nutty Professor, the remake with Eddie Murphy, where the comic was attacking the Nutty Professor in the audience, and he was really overweight.
Yeah.
And you could see how sad he was. Now, if there's an overweight person that won't shut the fuck up and this and that, well, then they're opening up the door.
It's go time.
I'm not going to say fatso.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. You just got to know how to read people.
Well, the way you described it, it sounds like you have an ideal of what's mean or hurtful. Yeah. And that's your line. But there seems to be a line too. Mean is okay if it's attacking hypocrisy or if it's not individualized to someone's appearance, weight. Like it seems it's a fine line. And then if someone's opens up to playfulness, they're overweight or, you know, they're taking out their glass eye and cleaning it in the front row. It's like, all right, man, let's have a talk about your eye.
You know, it's so weird too. That's funny. Take out their eye and clean it. But, you know, weight, listen, I wish I lost 15 pounds. I couldn't even imagine being 200 pounds overweight. But yet, you can attack an alcoholic that's a phobic, a heroin addict that you could tell is on drugs in New York. But food is an addiction too. So what addictions are okay to talk about and which ones aren't? In Vegas, I talk about gambling. Mm-hmm. You know, but what addictions? And I guess the only one that right now that hurts people or could damage is weight, most likely.
Yeah.
When it comes to addictions, you know, if I say, you know, like you're, you know, can have a gamble, whatever. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
And that's only going to have, that's if I'm doing crowd work. I'm just doing material. I'm not, I mean, I made fun when I was in Vegas. I got to rewrite this because it worked. There was a, in the casino I was working, there was a vending machine that sold big pieces of cake. It was a cake vending machine. And I'm going, you know, who's ever using, going there probably doesn't have a treadmill at home. You know, who the fuck's waking up in the middle of the night going, oh, where can I get a piece of cake from?
The cake machine.
You know, which is to me ridiculous.
Oh, it's crazy.
You know, is that, you know, does somebody wake up, oh God, I could go for a brisket, you know?
Yeah. You could eat anywhere in this country. You can't fill your car out with gas. It's like, this is time to eat. You're going to put fuel in your car. Just start shoving things into your mouth.
Yes. Well, I wake up in the middle of the night, have a cookie.
Yeah.
I'm a sugar addict.
I would do that with the cigarettes.
I do that with Nicorette gum. I'll wake up to go piss and then I'll stay up another half an hour with a piece of Nicorette gum in my mouth. Sometimes I fall asleep with it in my mouth. I'm going to choke to death one night.
Oh my God.
You know, it's just, well, the country is just one big fucking addicted country.
It's pain. I mean, what causes addictions? Pain. It's all our pain of unresolved pain.
Happiness causes addiction too, you don't think?
I think the need for happiness that a sober mind can't achieve. Like I couldn't achieve a settlement that I was looking for. I had a lot of fun at times. But other times, once I got into that, I crossed that late stage thing, I could not manage any thought that seemed hopeful without at least drinking. Even if I was thinking of going to rehab for the 10th time, I would go and have a couple drinks to even consider this. Let me get a plan. I got to get my mind to unwind. But I think it's unresolved pain, and it's a sense of shallow purpose. If I could be general, I'm not saying that's the answer, but what I relate to the people I talk to, and as it just, that's the pattern that comes up. It's some unresolved pain in their story that addiction gives you this illusion that you connected or got rid of it, or that you've lost a sense of purpose. It's not even looking for happiness because cheesesteaks make me happy. I could eat a great cheesesteak, take a nap, and I'm like, that's what I wanted today.
Yeah, I guess unresolved. Yeah, there is a lot of unresolved issues in, I guess, my, you know, parent issues, abandonment, narcissistic father. But what I have done is raise kids and did the complete opposite.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have forgiven my mother who passed away, but you know, I was in tears a couple of weeks ago and I didn't cry when she died.
Yeah.
Because I knew she had Alzheimer's. But you know, I had tears in my eyes thinking about what a struggle it must have been for her with three kids.
Yeah.
as a single mom.
Yeah.
A fucking dad that, you know, barely sent her fucking child support, this and that, and who's a narcissist. My dad's 94 now.
94.
I don't know if I still have forgiven him.
Yeah.
You know, but the way I think I have is I raised my kids completely opposite, and I got really good kids. I showed them attention, affection, 1,000 pictures of them, went to all their sporting events. I was there for my kids. So there's still a piece of me that has anger towards my dad.
I can relate.
But I know I did do the right thing with my kids. So, you know, from my horrible, horrible parent made me a good parent.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that in your story. It translates in the sense that that's a resentment that didn't kill you and it didn't affect your kids. So there is forgiveness in there. There's still a judgment that I had. I had the same with my dad. When he died, I got more. I forgave him more when he was dead because I had my firstborn, my child. And I'm thinking, what wouldn't I have done? I did this in a meditation. It's called a metta. Because I didn't know how to make amends to my dad. We always had a really awful relationship. He's a volatile guy. He's in recovery. I was thinking of him. What did he look like when he was 5? He had a hair lip. And that 10 minutes into that meditation, Rich, I started crying, thinking, well, I have a baby, first baby in my house. What would I have done to, who didn't protect my dad that made him the way he was?
Oh, yeah. And
somewhere in that, like that, that creative thought, I was like, who am I going to blame? Where does it start? Where does it end? Am I going to blame some guy in a kilt 200 years ago that was, this caused all our mayhem and it just stayed with us? I had to let it go.
Yeah, but my grandparents on my father's side were great.
Yeah.
They were great. My grandparents on my mother's side, racist from Russia, just, you know, just horrible. And we lived above them for free.
Yeah.
We had a multifamily house. And my mother and we lived upstairs for free because my mother had no money. And I remember my mother taking me, my brother and sister to my grandparents on my father's side, knocking on the door and saying, take them, I don't want them.
Oh,
she just wanted to go out that.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
She wanted to go out as a single mom, take them. You know, she couldn't find a babysitter. But as a kid, like, holy fuck. What do you mean? Take them, I don't want. And my grandparents were so fucking great on my father's side.
Yeah.
They were just great. You know, so I don't think it was them that my father was so fucked up. You know, he the same as me, gambler.
Yeah.
No, I'm married 3 times. I mean, his marriage now has been 40 years, but
wow.
3 years married.
And he's 94.
Yeah. I was getting high when he got married. So 38 years probably married. His second wife didn't last. That was a couple of years.
Is he still with it? Is he, you could talk, you guys talk?
Yeah, he's 94. I call him every now and then, you know.
Yeah.
I got this fucked up thing in my head. Like I used to go to his house and he's got these beautiful, this artwork pictures. I go, I love that. I want that. And I just know when he passes away, everything in his will be to his wife's kids.
Yeah.
Not to us, not to me and my sister and my, I just know. And I'm sitting here going, if they call me, if she says, and this is really fucked up thinking,
not like
his wife calls me and says, your dad passed, you know, you're going to have to help pay for the funeral. I go, let me see the will first. You know, and that's like when my mom died, I pay, you know, or brother, I paid whatever we had to pay. I had no problem. I mean, they're criminals, funeral directors, but I had no problem. But I would have a problem paying for his.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fucked up thinking.
No, I don't think it's too uncommon. I mean, it's the stuff we pretend isn't going on. Like when people sit down and talk, but I think you've been around enough people, I've been crackheads, addicts, that lost all hope, get a second chance at life. We talk about these things and it doesn't sound abnormal to me. I think other people that get really sick think they're the only ones thinking it. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah. I'm always thinking that when I die, I mean, am I going to do good numbers at my funeral? I went to my friend's funeral. He did about 500 people. I got to beat him.
Yeah. Numbers.
Yeah. I'll never know.
Yeah.
I got to fake my death just to see the numbers I'll do.
Yeah. Facebook has taken the place of that. I'm going to be calling friends on their birthday. Where are your numbers at? What do you got now? 100? And I'm like, I'll call you back in 3 hours. You got to beat each other's birthday comments.
Well, that's true. I do get good numbers on my birthday on Facebook. I mean, you know, it's drug addiction and alcoholism, and you know, you have to make that own decision for yourself.
You do.
No one's going to make it for you. And I remember before my mom died. Well, I mean, me getting sober was, you know, what do you call it, for my parents, you know, them seeing me get sober, you know, was an amends.
Yeah.
Just seeing that. And also when my mother was in the hospital, she has Alzheimer's, but I told her I was sorry for everything I did. I might have told her that when she was alive, but probably not. But them seeing me from being a drug addict to raising a family with kids, I think, and I'm pretty sure, was a pretty strong amends.
Yeah.
You know, I would imagine that, you know.
Do you have moments that we still consider where if I didn't get sober, like, this is the second chance at life? Do you feel that way sometimes when you wake up?
Oh, if I didn't get sober, I'd be dead.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I say it, I don't... I don't sit here and go, this is a second chance at life because I got sober young.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, as much as I can, try to carry the message.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote a really good bit out of it because my wife laughed at me, you know, and I said, you know, maybe I'm a comic to carry the message. And the bit is, you know, it's arrogant because I'm on stage, you know, maybe God kept me clean because I assassinated John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, but kept me clean. You know, to talk to 100 people in fucking Edmonton, you know, she pretty much put a fucking clamp on that idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, but it's true. You never know. I mean, I'm on radio all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I never break the 11th tradition.
Uh-huh.
I do say I'll go to a 12-step meeting, which is not breaking the 11th.
Tradition.
Yeah. But you'll hear celebrities or, oh, I go here, I go there. And next thing you know, they're getting high.
Mm-hmm.
And the regular people go, see, that doesn't work. You know, and that's the main reason for the 11th tradition is to shut your fucking mouth. So, you know, you know, you're in the public's eye and you have fucking 2 months clean and you're out there raving. And then 2 months later, you get high. And people going, see, that doesn't work. That cult doesn't work.
Or, you know, taking on another identity with a political faction, right, left, it doesn't matter, or something that now you just alienated 50% of the people that think, is this part of recovery too? That's where it gets dicey for me. I think there's great value in saying you're in recovery. It breaks stigma and it tells people, but I do protect the 12-step organizations I go to. I don't say them by name. And I work in a treatment center too.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's still a weird line. My ideas have changed the last couple of years about it. Like when I first, I was sober 14 years and relapse. But when I was first sober, I wouldn't have done anything like this. I wouldn't be comfortable. But that changed after I relapsed. It kind of woke me up like, oh, my God, I still have this. This is going to kill me.
I would imagine after 14 years.
Oh, it was a nightmare.
That progression had to be, that had to take about a week.
Yeah, it was like I was 24 again. And I thought since I could drink in 3 days a bottle of Jameson, it was in a city. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm still healthy. Like, this isn't progression. I have a good metabolism. I'm a very healthy guy.
Well, I don't know how. I don't think politics is brought into recovery.
No.
I don't think I've ever really heard somebody.
I saw some dicey stuff in the last 2 years, but it was people. It was excusable. We all knew each other, but I've seen people flare up.
I've seen maybe after a meeting, but I mean, if you're bringing it up during a meeting,
yeah,
I remember I was doing the show in Palm Springs. I brought another comic who was mm-hmm. in recovery. And it was the second biggest convention next to World Convention. I mean, thousands of people. And I'm walking in the day through, by the pool and the yard and all these people outside without shirts on and, it was like walking through a prison yard. You saw fucking gang signs, Nazi emblems, swastika,
wow. This
and
that.
And it didn't really phase. He bailed out.
Yeah.
He was with girl. He goes, I'm not doing this. And I go, well, at least these fucking people are trying to get clean.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went on stage that night and fucking slaughtered. It was one of the best.
Oh, that's awesome.
I taped a special at a 12-step convention.
Really?
Yeah, I was the first one ever. We got permission. I didn't show the audience.
Sure.
It's supposed to come out in June. I didn't show the audience. My backdrop is, I set the stage up like it's a meeting with a coffee pot.
Oh, that's awesome.
All the signs.
Oh, man.
Circle chairs with books on each one of them. And, that's my back. That's behind me, and it's supposed to come. I taped it 4 years ago. My manager's useless, but finally it's going up.
June?
I think June 1st.
Will that be available on richvoss.com? Yeah.
I don't know where. It's going to be on like this online. I'm trying to find a picture. Here. Let's see if you can see this. Oh, you can probably see this. Can you see that picture?
No, you got to go up a little more and pull it back a little.
Oh, wait.
And that looks like a clubhouse. That's a meeting with the lampshades. Cool. Yeah. That's a nice set.
Yeah. I think it's supposed to go on like Pluto TV or.
Yeah, Pluto.
I never promoted it anywhere. Like I would never. I mean, when we do Zoom meetings, when it comes out mm-hmm. after the meeting, when we do the parking lot talk, I'll bring it up then. I won't bring it up during the meeting. That's self-promotion.
If I catch it, you can't stop me. I'll promote it.
I promote it on podcasts.
Yeah.
But I don't know where it's going to work. They're starting this online network called Switch. So I don't know what venues it's going to go to. It's 4 years old, but the material, I guess, is, there's some recovery stuff, there's some stand-up, there's some crowd. It's funny because I was taping, and I went over now, and all of a sudden I'm on stage, and people are walking out. I'm going, what the fuck did I say? I go, well, where did I, and they're walking out, and I'm still got a few minutes. I guess I went over and what they expected at this convention. And I got off stage. I go, well, what did I do? Why were people walking out? They go, well, they went to see the Midnight Speaker. You're going to see the Midnight Speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I'm going, oh, shit. No one told me to be done by midnight.
Oh, that sucks.
No one told me. I would have wrapped it up at 11:45. I mean, you can't tell people leaving because the camera's on me. Like, I'm not showing the audience.
Yeah.
But it's so weird. I'm going, what did I say?
So you've been in comedy for three decades. Over Almost three decades. Four decades. Huh? Writing, stand-up, television. and you've been sober for most of that. What is it about comedy? Like, what's the most fulfilling moment you, if you took those 4 years in a summary, what is it about your profession that's healing? That just, you would never stop doing this.
I have respect for my peers.
Yeah.
Very well respected for my peers. The industry, they're scumbags anyhow.
Sure.
So there's about quick fixes and making money. And, you know, if I walked into a club and lit the wait staff on fire, if it was sold out, they wouldn't care.
Yeah.
I have respect throughout the comedy community, the stuff I've accomplished and who I am. So that's probably the most satisfying,
it's community. I mean, there's a community.
There's comics that are making millions of dollars a year.
Yeah.
No other comics quoting them. No comics are going, oh, did you hear what that person said? Or,
yeah.
You know, so I have respect amongst my peers, which you can't buy.
You can't. And there is a distinguished, comedy's different than actors hanging out. In my opinion, I remember even Seinfeld's documentary. Whoa. The comedian.
Yeah.
Just gives you a peek at like, this isn't actors. This is its own community. And if you're respected in it, it's got to feel fulfilling, because this, not many people, there's very few people that could do this. This is.
Yeah, but that documentary, it's so, I remember it. And I remember they put this comic in Orny Adams. Everybody.
Oh yeah. I couldn't stand that.
Yeah. But the reason they did that, because who gives a shit about a guy flying around in a private jet?
Yeah.
That's worth, you know, $200 million.
Yeah.
So Seinfeld was smart. He saw this fucking idiot. He's going, this guy's a real, I got to put him in as the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know,
wow. So people
go, what in it? I mean, that had to be why he did it.
Yeah. Because at first I'm thinking, is he his sponsor? Well, how's he taking up this much real estate in a film? I'm like, he's kind of, I don't know. He's hard to like.
Yeah, I know him real well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to like.
In the visuals, I don't know the man, but I'm saying from the way he was presented, it was like, it looked like just sheer desperation. But then at the end, it was like the tenacity. He doesn't quit. He keeps working. You're like, oh, I don't fully understand this. I don't fully understand what I'm watching. Like, you have to work. He was working at it.
Yeah. Well, Seinfeld was smart because nobody cares until you put the complete opposite.
Yeah, that's right.
We made a great documentary, my wife and I, Women Aren't Funny.
Yeah.
And she, you know, directed whatever. But it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, it was pretty good. It's so funny. Every time I see Seinfeld, hey, how you doing? But he's not as open or loose as other
approachable.
He's not a mean guy at all.
Yeah, no.
And he's not a mean guy. He just, well, protects himself. He's fucking Seinfeld.
Yeah, you know, sure.
Everywhere he goes, you know, but like I do radio with Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
Like hanging out with a guy that I grew up with. I mean, just laughing and just a regular fucking jackass. That's so brilliant and funny. But I've done radio with him like 3 or 4 times, and you know, or when he's in New York, I talk to him, and you know,
he's quick.
And you're like, this guy is so funny, and he's so generous with his laughter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's just like hanging out. Like I've trashed him and he's just laughed. You know what I mean?
It's a great laugh. He explodes.
Yeah, you're not going to really trash Seinfeld and get him to laugh, like, or Chris, like,
yeah,
you know, certain people are different, you know.
Yeah, sure.
You know, whatever. I mean, it's just like, it's so weird. One night I was at the Cellar and I'm sitting at a table with Chappelle, Louis C.K., Chris Rock, Bradley Cooper, and some other comic. And Chappelle lights up. He's smoking a cigarette. No one said a fucking word. You know, that was Joe Schmo that lit a cigarette. They would have said, "Get, put that fucking thing out." You know?
Yeah. But, you know, God, yeah.
None of them said it to Chappelle, you know. But you're sitting at a table. Like, I was a drug addict that quit fucking school, you know. And I was, something that's really cool, like my guidance counselor from school, I was a fuck up. I quit. And I posted a picture of my granddaughter, and she wrote to me, and she goes, "You've come a long way," or something.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, I went to one of my high school reunions, even though I didn't graduate. I did 15 minutes on stage.
Oh,
and
man.
I apologized to her, my guidance counselor, for the hell I put her through.
Wow.
Sorry, Miss Minister. You know, but to have my guidance counselor write to me on Facebook and go, "I'm very proud of you." You know what I mean? Yeah. It's kind of weird.
Yeah,
it's a good feeling.
It's great. How many people get to experience that? Very few. We know a lot of people who don't.
It's a good feeling, you know, yeah. to gain, you know.
Rich, I met Louis C.K. once. I sold him a set of lenses for the second season of Louis. I had a set of lenses I got off a Paramount set. I was a filmmaker, and they were the only Super Beltars in the world that were still the same stuff. He's a gearhead. He loves production gear. And my friend was his cameraman. I said, "Could we use those lenses?" I said, "Sure." A day went by. They didn't bring them back. They were like renting them off me. I'm like, "What's up, man? You guys rap?" And he goes, "He wants to buy them off you." I got them for like at an auction for 10 grand. And I said, "No, I don't want to sell them. Tell him if I did, it would have to be like 30. Because I could shoot a lot of stuff for 30. Yeah. He called back in an hour. He took them. I was like, "Dude, man, this guy's wild." It's like this
guy. He could have said 50.
Probably. Yeah, I was angry. I was like, "Oh, man, I should have went."
No, I mean 30 a piece.
Yeah.
I gotta wrap this up.
Hey, man, thanks. And your podcast, it's you and your wife have a podcast?
My wife hates me.
My wife hates me.
So, on iTunes or anywhere, Stitcher or whatever, they find fucking
podcasts. So many of them. Rich, I want to thank you. And I got to thank Mark for putting us together. I was really excited to meet you and wanted to talk to you for some time.
I absolutely said nothing and I talked too much. So sorry.
I'm glad we got to fill the hour with all of it.
All right. Well, good luck with the podcast. Don't ever call me again. Where are you a counselor? In Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, Lake Ariel.
Where?
Avenues, Lake Ariel.
Where's that by? Scranton? Or?
Yeah, I'm in Scranton. You're in the Scranton Addict right now.
I think I'm working New Year's Eve in Scranton.
Really? We're at the casino? Yeah. I'll come down.
I wish I was in there to come speak at your rehab.
Well, let's see if we can. I'll check this week because this summer comes up. We try to book some people to come in, do stuff, band. So, and I'll check with Mark. Mark.
I don't charge to speak in a rehab.
No. Yeah.
No, I mean, I'll speak. I mean, I would do a show. But that's different than speaking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're always in need of speakers 5 days a week. I'll drop you an email and you tell me when you're coming through. I'll make that night happen at 8 o'clock. If you could come up to the rehab at 7 o'clock any night.
See, maybe New Year's Eve before my show.
We would love that, man.
Keep me posted. I'll forget. So
I'll send you an email.
All right, cool.
Thanks, Rich.
All right, I'm
good luck tonight, man. Break a leg.
Me. All right.
I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right. Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.